This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
I mean, through history and through American history, you know, we've always had presidents who bring people together by inspiring them and who make inspiring, unifying speeches. I mean, you know, I mean, you can talk about Lincoln, you can talk about Obama, you can talk about, Eisenhower, FDR. I mean, it's a nonpartisan skill. Both Democrats and Republicans have been able to do it in the past. Reagan, of course.
If they can just get an inspiring, thoughtful speech down to a 15-second TikTok with some sexy editing and lean towards moderation, our democracy is going to be fine.
That's right.
Okay. Hey, Jordan, good to be back. Listen, there's a lot of politics. We're going to have a chance to get into some of that with our guest. But I cannot believe that starting this week, football's back, the NFL. Don't we get a break? I guess it must be all about money. Is that drives this? I mean,
We
16 games and all these preseason games. Do you ever get tired of it?
I do think money, you don't need to go much farther than that. I think money is probably it. It is exhausting. I have the energy for about a fandom for 4 months of the year. And so all my energy goes towards college football. And then, as we've talked about, some NBA when that gets going. And everything else is sort of, if I'm around, if I got time. NFL, okay, I guess I'll watch some of it. Truthfully, I'm a college man, you know? That's my tribalistic instincts. Give me the Wolverines. Give me the drama. Give me a coach who's camping out in trees trying to recruit people. That's my fan base right there.
And how you feeling about the upcoming Wolverines vis-a-vis Ohio State? I'll opine a little bit about Ohio State, but what do you think about how they're going to do?
I think, you never know a ton preseason-wise. I think the team looks strong this year. I think they had a great year last year, one of the best we've had in a couple decades. Ohio State couldn't beat us last year. I don't think they'll beat us this year. So I'm feeling pretty good going into it all.
Okay, now there we go. So how much do we want to bet on that game? Do you want to bet $5?
$5?
That's steep for me.
Is that really high? I mean, I'm saying we could even double it. We could make it a $10 bet.
All right, let's go $10, flat out even. I think they're playing at Ohio State this year. Uh-huh. And Ohio State looks very, very strong. I mean, looks awesome. But remember we had Costas on and we were talking about NIL. And how about the money these players are getting? I mean, they're even getting people who were in high school apparently are signing NILs and reaping rewards. I mean, what do you think this is changing the game?
Sure. I mean, I think it's totally going to change the game. I think. Change is the one constant we have, and I don't know if you were ever going to keep it the way it was. It's the money these colleges are making, the video games these kids are playing, the characters they become in the world of social media. I understand that it's a big business. If you can make a living being a shit-posting TikToker at age 14, well, if you're pretty good at playing football, maybe you can make a little living at 17. So I'm not going to hate on it, but it's changing. What are you going to do?
Yeah. So, you live right there in New York. So the big news today for those who are baseball fans is it looks like the Mets are coming on and the Yankees kind of stumbling. I saw a little bit of headlines in the sports on television today. It looks as though it is a possibility of a Subway Series. So the question is, are you getting me any ticks?
Am I getting you tickets?
Yeah.
Governor,
when we go, what do you think about that?
You know what? It sounds exciting, but then when I imagine the length of a baseball game is, I think last time I checked, 6.5 hours. So you and me, 6.5 hours.
Yeah.
This podcast is already long enough.
You know
do
what?
You, want, you, do
know
you really
what?
Want us to bicker for 6.5 hours,
you know what?
At a baseball game?
I would say that, yeah, we probably wouldn't make it unless we were drinking a lot. That's
this
the
is
only
it.
Way.
We would get, I don't, you know, we had to see how the red wine situation is at Yankee Stadium. I'd get some bourbons and, you know, maybe we'd hash it out.
It might not be a bad idea. It might not be a bad idea.
You know what? I was quick to judge. Maybe this is where that elusive common ground, it might be found in the eighth inning, four drinks deep with Judge up to bat. Maybe that's where it lies.
Boy, can that guy hit. Now, Jordan, at some point, I'm not going to press you on it today. We got to give it a little bit of time. But we're going to have some predictions here about these midterms, you know, what we expect is going to happen. Mm-hmm. So I want you to think hard about what predictions you want to make, because I'm going to hold you your prediction.
All right. Governor, I'm excited about our guest today. Our guest this week is a Pulitzer Prize winning historian, best-selling author, and journalist covering geopolitics and foreign policy. She's currently a staff writer for The Atlantic, and her newest bestseller, Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism, is available now. Anne Applebaum, it's an honor to have you on, Anne.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
The Twilight of Democracy. You saw it coming, huh? It feels like you really struck a nerve. And I feel like I continue to read Anne Applebaum articles as they are sent to me as I'm going to Hungary. I literally went to Hungary a few months ago with just a stack of all of your words, trying to educate myself quickly. You are feeding me knowledge, and I thank you for it.
Thank you.
I actually wanted...
I happen to write about a part of the world that in which I watched the democracy decline, and it turned out to be more relevant to U.S. politics than I thought it would be.
Yeah, well, I wanted to actually jump in and talk a little bit about that. Like I said, I was in Hungary recently, and you've written about it. In fact, Viktor Orban is coming to CPAC this week, and he's not coming to D.C. to talk to Biden. He's coming to CPAC to talk to the conservatives of America. And I'm curious, from your perspective, what is it that American conservatives see in Viktor Orban? How much of it has to do with the cultural issues that he's talking about, and how much has to do with the effectiveness he has with holding on to power?
So you've actually pinpointed the two things that I think they admire in Orban. One of them is the fact that he's been in office for so long. How has he remained in office for so long is by changing the rules of his political system. I mean, in his case, he was able to manipulate the Hungarian constitution, constantly reforming it and rewriting it. He's engaged in a form of gerrymandering. He's got mostly control of his judiciary, so he can personally avoid any investigations, deep investigations into corruption. He's also got hold of the media in Hungary, so there isn't really any, there's certainly no newspapers and no major television channels that belong to anybody who's not either the government or a business leader close to the government. And that's a model of illiberalism, a form of taking over the state, a form of changing the electoral rules that I think some people in the modern Republican Party admire. I won't say all the Republican Party, but there's clearly a part of it that does. And then I think the second thing they admire about him is that one of the ways he has done this and has in effect covered up doing this is by fighting a perpetual culture war. So he doesn't talk too much about ordinary life. He doesn't necessarily deal with the problems that Hungarians face. He doesn't advertise the fact that he's undermining Hungarian democracy. Instead, he focuses relentlessly on cultural enemies. And in his case, that's LGBT. He would describe it as a lobby, but he focuses on, the academic studies of gay and lesbian issues. He focuses on the threat that he says George Soros, and who is a symbol for international Judaism, poses to the Hungarian nation. And he also promotes a form of the replacement theory. In other words, that There's a secret plot to replace Hungarians with brown people, Muslims from other places. And George Soros, in fact, is the person who's mainly responsible for this plot. And so he focuses people on things they're afraid of, things they're scared of. And he keeps the conference, he kind of keeps raising the level of shock and anger. And this is how he does politics in Hungary. And this is also a model of doing politics that I think some people in the Republican Party also admire.
And why do you think authoritarianism is seductive? Because you've written that. You say that it's seductive. What's your sense of why? What makes it that way?
In some ways, it's the default position of humanity. If you look back over human history, over time, most governments or most political systems, most states have been authoritarian. I think authoritarianism answers a need that some people have for security. And also, at a time when there is an enormous amount of information, enormous amount of argument online and in real life, authoritarianism offers a single unified answer to questions and a way of silencing all those arguments. And if you are the kind of person who's bothered by conflict, whether it's violent conflict or verbal conflict, then authoritarianism seems to be an answer. You know, I often hear people say, usually they're talking about China, but they say, well, you know, at least authoritarians, they can plan things better. At least they have a longer term perspective. At least they can have unified answers to questions. They're not always arguing with their opponents. And people, of course, forget that most authoritarian countries look a lot more like Zimbabwe or, you know, Eritrea than they look like China. And of course, even China, once you get down into the nitty gritty of how China is actually governed, you would find an enormous amount of discontent and unhappiness with the way decisions are made there. Exhibit A being the catastrophic COVID policy, both at the very beginning when they tried to cover it up and more recently when they locked people up in order to prevent anybody from getting it. But for days and days and weeks, people were shut inside their houses. But nevertheless, the idea, the image or the myth that somehow the Chinese do things better, they're more efficient, they're better than us, is something that people find appealing. And also the idea that, you know, if we didn't have all this squabbling here in America, we would get things done in a more efficient way.
So let's just go back for a second, because when you say it's sort of the default position, but throughout history also has been a yearning to overthrow the yoke of the people who were in charge. I mean, if we go back and study, you know, the history of Israel throughout the very beginning of time, really, there was always an effort by Israelites, Jews, to be able to free themselves from the yoke of their oppressors. When we look at the total glee and unbelievable celebrations that occurred with the collapse of the wall, you know, in Berlin, when we look at Venezuela today, or we look at Russia today, and we think about the work of people like Navalny, it seems to me as though there is a yearning inside of every individual to be free from oppressors. But oppressors can be, as I think you point out, vicious, right?
I completely agree with you. I mean, by default, I said I meant that most political regimes going back, if you go back several thousand years, that's what you find.
Yeah.
But you also find this drive that has been there for just as long, for independence, for freedom from authority, and also for justice, for the rule of law, to live in a political system where you have some rights and where the law is not just what a powerful person says it is, but it has some independent status. I mean, you see this, you're right, it's just as ancient and just as old. I've just come back from Ukraine, where I spent a lot of time on this trip in Odessa and a little bit in Kiev with people who are working as volunteers on behalf of the army or on behalf of refugees, who are giving their time, who are organizing crowdfunding, who are trying to help win the war. And all of those people, and there are thousands of them, are motivated by exactly what you describe. You know, this belief that if they remain Ukrainian, they will be inside a democracy. They will have rights. They won't live. It's the desire not to be an autocratic state. And this for them is really life and death. But you're right. You see it in Venezuela. You see it in Cuba. You see it in Burma. You see it in Nicaragua. Yeah, you see it also in China.
Yeah. And China with the Uyghurs, you know.
The Uyghurs, the Hong Kong Chinese, mainstream China, mainland Chinese. There are lots. And it's not easy to be a Democrat in China. And there is an enormous amount of pressure now pushing back against it. But you're right.
I mean, it's interesting. In your book, Twilight of Democracy, you grapple with some of these ideas of watching people lean towards authoritarianism, somewhat of a slide, even friends towards fascism, and pointing to this idea that a lot of it is rooted in humiliation and resentment on a personal level. Can you expand on that?
So I think there is in many Western democracies, many established democracies, many people have a sense of personal disappointment, and sometimes it's ideological disappointment. This isn't the country that I thought it was. You know, whether you're a Pole who thought that the political transition would be different, or an American who remembers a time, or think you remember a time when things were easier or simpler. And sometimes that's accompanied by personal disappointment. You know, I didn't have the political career that I wanted to have or that I deserved to have, or and therefore the choice of a political alternative, you know, can be both personal and political. It's also very hard to pick apart the human brain. I mean, people have motives that involve their own careers and are also ideological or religious, or, you know, people have many motives at once. But I think if you use the word disappointment and you talk about people being disappointed with the status quo, disappointed with the establishment, then you begin to get to some of the explanation for the phenomenon that we've seen.
Do you think actually that's an interesting focus there? Do you think specifically in the American conversation around, I feel like there's been a million op-eds trying to grapple with this current moment and watching people with these certain leanings, is there too much attempting to put it on things like religion and ideology when they should be focusing on something as simple as just basic human disappointment?
I think if you focus on disappointment, and also if you focus on this thing I referred to before, which is cacophony, you know, the noise of contemporary life and the speed of change, which not everybody is good at dealing with. That's also related to economics and education and other things. But if you think about the amount that people have had to absorb, you know, sociological change, demographic change, economic change, informational change, just over the last 10 years, you know, let alone the past 20 years, you find that people have developed a kind of nostalgia for something else. You know, they're disappointed with the nature of contemporary life, and they, you know, imagine that if you go back to something earlier or you go back to another time, it will be better. And I think that's often at the root of, whatever ideology people put on top of it.
We'll be right back. And now back to the show.
And I think it's at the root of it is maybe even something more basic. And that is, and I found it out back in the days when I was running for president, I think people feel like they don't matter, that the cards are stacked against them. I mean, in their own lives, they're not seeing the kind of wealth growth, or, you know, this whole issue of the growing divide between the rich and the poor. And that rich guy gets all this and I don't get anything. And I'm living in a community where, you know, there's opiates and I can't control that. And by the way, I see the politicians, you know, they get away with murder and I get nothing, and they get, you know, sky high Social Security retirement benefits, and they've taken all mine away. I think it's a sense that people feel both lonely and the fact that cards have been stacked against us. And I think you got a guy running for president who says John McCain's not a hero because he got caught. And you say, how does a guy get elected when he says something like that? But it brought me back to the point where it seemed as though Donald Trump or any of these other people are just in the game of monopolies just spilled over the board. And people are like, yeah, I'm tired of this, but I'm not going to play this game anymore because I can never win. It's all stacked against me. If you look around the world, it's the threat to me of the growth of democracy. You look at the ouster of Boris Johnson. People felt, you know, here's this guy partying over there at in his place and hanging out all over the world. And here I am struggling to make ends meet. And I think that the underpinning of democracy, if you want to stabilize it, I think it gets down to being able to tell people that I care about you, that you're in the game, that you're not ignored, that another group of people don't get all the benefits. And when people get a sense that they're removed from that, then I think they begin to lose their support and they begin to think about, well, who's going to come in and fix it? That's what I think is a big issue, not only in our country, but in the Western world right now.
I agree with you. And, you know, democracy has always been about being able to throw out the people in power.
Yeah.
And, you know, in a way, you know, we use this word populism a lot, but in a way, almost every election has a populist element. I mean, somebody is saying the guys in power are bad and, you know, they're a corrupt elite and we're going to take over and throw them out. The difference in the last several years has been adding to that a sense that it's not just the people in power who I want out, it's the whole system that I want out.
Exactly.
That I don't trust the system. I don't believe the system is going to produce people who will ever think about people like me. And that's you've pinpointed exactly
big labor, big business, big sports, all of it has that resonance. You know, my view is that it's all connected. The bigness means I'm kind of lost. And the speed of change, which you point out, the speed of people feel like, well, wait a minute, what do I grab onto? I think that's a big chunk of it.
And as I said, I think it's coupled with a sense that things used to be different or the world used to be a better place for people like me.
Yeah.
And now people like me don't have a place in it. And that's also why, for example, this replacement theory, this conspiracy theory about white people being replaced by other people is so powerful, because it echoes something that, as you say, people feel that the world isn't made for me anymore.
What do you see as some of these dangers we have? Specifically, Orban comes to CPAC, he's put on this pedestal, and just recently he made news for talking about Hungary being a place where they didn't want mixed races. And that caused such a stir there that even an aide of his stepped down, calling it a pure Nazi text. And I understand, and I think it's important for Americans to look at places like Hungary. And Hungary is a different ecosystem than America, and it very much also has different ideals. But I would argue that, like, the American ideal is one of a melting pot, is one of people coming from afar, coming together, and they may be in some ways different than what Hungarians see themselves as, or as some Hungarians see themselves as. Is there a danger, or what do you see as the dangers of a Republican Party looking at Orban and either choosing to look away from some of these darker comments that he makes that seem to be antithetical to the American identity? Or is this just saying the quiet part out loud?
I think, unfortunately, it's saying the quiet part out loud. I mean, that Orban thought like that has been clear for a long time. And by the way, the word he used, he talked about he doesn't want mixed races. He actually used a word that's closer to species, you know, as if humans were incompatible with one another. And I think as I said, the idea that my kind of person is being replaced and is disappearing is something that, again, a piece of the Republican Party, the Trumpist wing of the Republican Party, also sees as a powerful conspiracy theory that can motivate people. Of course it's racist, but it's something even deeper than that. I mean, it's racist plus, you know, as I said, it's connected to this sense of despair, and that's why it's working so well right now. And I agree with you, it's absolutely in opposition to everything that America is and always has been. I mean, it's always been a place where people, you know, we used to talk about people being Irish and Italian, you know, and Polish as those people being also culturally incompatible, but then it turned out that they were. And so we've had this argument going on in America for a long time about whether new kinds or different kinds of people can fit in. Invariably they always do. In Hungary, the language is particularly nasty because there isn't that tradition And so it's clear that what Orban is talking about is both he's both echoing old anti-Semitic language, and he's also echoing modern racist language. I mean, all of which is totally inappropriate for the United States, which has never had a anything like a, you know, blood and soil national identity the way the Hungarians have it. But as I say, there's a piece of now the Republican right that sees that as a useful kind of a useful conspiracy theory, a useful set of anxieties to hook on to, because it matches some things they want to encourage in the United States.
You know, a bit, let's just be fair about this, and let's just talk about the Democrat, liberal left-wing Democrat, who went and admired Fidel Castro and thought he mm-hmm. was a great leader, or mm-hmm. Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. They basically destroyed that country right now. And mm-hmm. I was in Congress at the time when we had a bunch of left-wingers that thought the Sandinistas were great. And you know what's happening in Nicaragua and what they have done to just destroy anybody that's in disagreement with them. I mean, it's just that both sides have a tendency to play with fire when it comes to extremism. The issue is, where's the middle? You know, does the middle buy into this kind of stuff?
Although is that would you agree that is it a both sides issue right now? It feels like, from my perspective, I understand that both sides at times will play into it, but it feels as though the danger is coming from one side specifically.
And so, what Governor Kasich? I mean, certainly what you're talking about is certainly true. There was in the past a left wing attraction to a form of liberalism or a form of autocracy, which was at that time communism.
Right.
You know, I've written extensively about that. I've written several books about communism in which I talk about this exact phenomenon. You know, at the moment, there is a much smaller part of the left, and it's not part of the Democratic Party so much. It's not, we're not talking about very many congressional Democrats who also espouse a form of liberalism. I mean, it's not so much pro-communist anymore. It's about other things. I mean, I think it's a rigid definitions that can't be crossed about identity and so on. But they are in some contexts that way of thinking is problematic, for example, at universities. But I don't think it's the political problem that the illiberal right now represents. I mean, there is actually a piece of our mainstream political, one of our mainstream political parties that is avowedly and openly illiberal, meaning that it's anti-democratic and it wants to change the nature of the American state, change the voting system, change the way we do things. And I don't see that matched by a similar, right now, by a similar movement inside the congressional or political Democratic Party.
Everything has its changes. Everything has a pendulum. And it's just like the pendulum that affects democracy or authoritarianism. Right now, because I think the leadership in the democratic societies have not responded to the fact that people have been so dissatisfied and feel as though they've been left alone, has gone the wrong way. And now we look at China and say, oh, well, look, because they have a dictator, they're able to just make decisions easier. That will change. Over time, that will change because the pendulum always swings one way or another. And now people are beginning, and I kind of look at what's happening in China. At one point, we couldn't say enough good about China. Now we can't say enough bad about China. It's a swinging pendulum, and pendulums tend to find their balances. And the fact that they're going to invite this Orban over here, that guy's a terrible guy, just terrible. And the fact that he's going to go speak at CPAC, but, you know, again, CPAC is like some extreme kind of thing now. It didn't used to be, but it's gotten more and more extreme. But I would say that both sides have had a tendency at times to play with people who didn't represent the kind of fundamental sense of democracy. And your point is well taken, and Jordan's point is well taken. If I could just spend a second, Anne, you spent a lot of time in the Soviet Union. Tell people what you found when you were over there about the nature of what happens in a totalitarian regime.
So I've spent a lot of time writing about the Soviet Union, and I did spend a summer in the Soviet Union as a student. I should be clear that it was a long time ago. Soviet Union has been gone since 1991.
Right. I know.
But I can certainly talk about the nature of the system. I mean, the primary thing I remember about living there, this is in about 1984, I think, 84, 85. The primary thing I can remember about living there was this palpable sense of fear. So people were afraid of one another. They were afraid of what they could say to one another. I remember as a foreigner, if I stopped on the street to ask somebody for directions, they would freeze up, you know, because obviously I spoke Russian, but I have an accent. And so, you know, not everybody would want to talk to a foreigner because that could get them in trouble. That's just a tiny example of what it was like. You know, people met privately, you know, in kitchens or in their apartments in order to have real conversations. Nobody spoke honestly in public. And there is a sense of constant restraint and anxiety. That I think, by the way, has an echo even now in contemporary Russia. I mean, you can hear as the Putin regime has grown harsher, it's almost as if people revert back to what they remember or what their parents described to them. You know, people are automatically afraid again. And so there is this atmosphere of fear. I mean, from reading and working in history, I know how it became like that. So the Soviet Union, and the Soviet satellite states had very clear policies that were designed, for example, you know, so there was full government control over all kinds of institutions, party control, I should say. The Communist Party controlled not just the state and not just politics, but also all major, you know, economic institutions, factories, warehouses, all major educational institutions, universities, schools, after school programs, kindergartens, and they controlled obviously the judiciary, the prosecution service. I mean, everything was essentially controlled by one small group of people who could then manipulate it in order to remain in power. And the other important aspect of it, and this has an important contemporary echo, is they also sought to control everything that we now call civil society. So everything from sports clubs to chess clubs to I don't know, amateur bird watching groups, you know, and then obviously including political groups and societies and organizations. So everything independent was somehow was supposed to be somehow connected to the Communist Party or controlled. And that sense that there's no outlet, there's no intellectual alternative, there's no way to be active in your life except by being part of the party and part of the state, is what created this atmosphere, this kind of suffocating atmosphere. Also, it was very, and a very cynical atmosphere, you know. So if you don't own anything and you can't progress except by paying homage to the party, then people become very cynical about everything, about education, about their jobs. There used to be a saying, you know, they pretend to pay us and we pretend to work, you know. You know, why should you know, if you're working for a government institution and you know that, you know, you have a sense of it, nothing you do mattering, then why should you try very hard? So it had all kinds of negative effects on people. It was created fear. It destroyed creativity. It undermined any sense of entrepreneurship. I mean, it was a genuinely evil political system.
In 2015, you said we're not yet in a new Cold War. I'm wondering how you would classify current international relations with Russia.
So I would say that it's the current international relations is not just important, you know, it's not just Russia. Russia has gone backwards very fast towards an old Soviet model, which is, of course, the model that Putin remembers that he grew up with. I would say that there is something else happening, though, aside from our obvious direct conflict with Putin and Putinism, which is that a number of other countries, including China, including Iran, including Venezuela, have also, these are countries that aren't all the same. They're not part of a bloc the way there was a Soviet bloc. They're not unified by some, you know, by some institution or even by some secret meeting. They don't all meet one another like in a James Bond movie somewhere and make decisions. And they have very different ideologies. You're talking about Chinese communism or Iranian theocracy or Venezuelan chavismo, you know, these are different systems. But we are now facing a world where there are a number of very powerful states, and Venezuela is powerful in the Latin American context, There are a number of very powerful states that have as their central interest the destruction of or the resistance to liberal democracy. In fact, the resistance to exactly that desire for freedom that Governor Kasich described a few minutes ago. So what does Russia see as its main, what does Putin see really, I should say not Russia, what does Putin see as the main threat to his form of autocratic, kleptocratic power? The main thing he sees is the power of spontaneous social organization. The numbers of people in Russia who would like a freer and more just system. I mean, forget about democracy, talk about justice. Why is he at war with Ukraine? Partly because the Ukrainians tried to create such a system. They tried to create a Slavic democracy in which they would have sovereignty and autonomy, and there would be some kind of rule of law, and there would be some way of having public conversations and arguments. That's one of the things that Putin hates about Ukraine. It's also what the Chinese hated about the Hong Kong demonstrations that were crushed a few years ago. You know, it's what the Venezuelan leadership hates about the Venezuelan opposition. So these are states which, as I said, they don't share everything, but they do have this common enemy. And they identify it both within their own countries, and they also identify it with us in America, in Europe, in other democracies world, Taiwan, other democracies around the world. And so it's not that we're in a cold war in the same way that we once were. But there is an ideological argument going on in the world, and it's playing itself out in the war in Ukraine. To some extent, it's playing itself out within the United States. And you can also see it within a number of European countries as well, and also in Asian countries.
And when you take a look at the savagery of the Russians in Ukraine, two things. One is, why does so much of the world choose to remain on the sidelines when pressed about supporting the Ukrainians? And number two, you said that we looked the other way when Putin was engaged in activities that really we should have, you know, whether it's Crimea, whether it's Chechnya, with some of the activity in Georgia. You say that we made a mistake by not looking at it and doing something about it. So I guess a two-part question is, what do you think we should have done about it? And secondly, when the world sits back and looks at the viciousness of the Russian activity, in particularly in Ukraine, why does the world kind of, big chunks of the world, look the other way?
So those are great questions. I mean, the first one, you know, why didn't we do anything about it? There were two pieces of that. One of them was, a refusal to change the status quo. So we had created, after the Cold War, a very comfortable, it was particularly comfortable for some European countries, comfortable relationship with Russia, whereby, you know, we had a trading relationship with them. A number of countries got relatively cheap gas, cheap energy from Russia. And the sort of revolution that was necessary to realize that our trading relationship with Russia had in fact enhanced and encouraged the development of a Russian dictatorship. And the realization that we were going to have to pay a huge cost to end this dependency has simply been an enormous political leap for many people and many leaders. In the United States, there was a tendency, starting with the Obama administration, or really starting earlier, but to minimize the significance of Russia. You know, it's a regional power. It doesn't matter that much. You know, we have bigger fish to fry. We're more interested in Asia. We're more interested in the Middle East, whatever it is. And the refusal to see that the growth in autocracy in Russia was going to require us to change our way of doing things, I think there was just a lot of resistance to that. You know, the people didn't like to change, you know, to pay a big political price or an economic price for that kind of realization. So there was a opposition to that that made it difficult for us to see. And then, as I said, moving to the next step, okay, what will we do about it? I think that, you know, what would the costs of that be? What would the impact be? I think there was just enormous enormous resistance. And I think the other piece of it is, and this is related to the second part, is that we also didn't see, Russia, we kept treating Russia as this regional power. Okay, they're not very nice to the Chechens. Okay, they've decided to be involved in Syria. Yeah. What we didn't see was that in each one of those cases, Russia wasn't just fighting the Chechens and wasn't just fighting the Syrians. It was also making known its views about the laws of war, about human rights, about all kinds of norms that we thought we had created in Europe and in the world after the Second World War. Grozny, the city, the capital city of Chechnya, looked a lot like Mariupol does today. It was burned to the ground. Thousands of people were killed. There was torture of political prisoners. All this has happened. Aleppo in Syria, same thing. And the Russians, each time they carried out an atrocity like that, they were waiting for us to react and say, no, but European norms, the UN values, whatever it was. And we did never reacted to it. And we simply kept treating these things as side issues, as smaller places. We didn't see them as central as they are. And I think, when you ask why isn't the rest of the world reacting, I think a lot of the rest of the world still hasn't faced that either. There's the degree to which the Russian assault on Ukraine represents, for example, a real threat in Africa. The idea that a large country can simply change its borders by invading and wiping out its neighbors is something that should frighten a lot of people in Africa or in Latin America or Asia or anywhere else. But people are choosing not to see this as that kind of challenge. I think there's a sort of secondary piece of it, which is that many people in other parts of the world, again, particularly Africa and the Middle East, tend to have already an inbuilt dislike or prejudice against the United States or against NATO. They say this is some kind of NATO-Russia conflict. They don't want to be involved. I don't think you see a lot of active support for Russia. Certainly, you see none in Europe. Europe is amazingly united in its understanding of this war. And outside of Europe, you see a lot of neutrality, but you don't see lots of people saying "rah rah, go Russia, destroy Ukraine." And I think it's more a kind of hands off, we don't want to be involved attitude rather than that. And I think the argument is winnable. Actually, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, was in Africa last week and has begun to make this argument. Do you understand what the significance of this war is? And I would like to see U.S. politicians doing that, too.
We'll be right back. And now back to the show.
It's interesting. When I turn on TV right now, I'm no longer seeing images of what's happening in Ukraine. I think Americans have a pretty short attention span. We were seeing images, and then suddenly we moved to stories on COVID, Roe v. Wade, the January 6th hearings. How much do you think the world's and especially America's ever fleeting attention span plays into Putin's plans?
So Putin is certainly planning on America losing its attention. He's counting on that. He's also counting on, a kind of cracks emerging in the relationship between America and Europe, as particularly Germans, but also Italians and others, pay much higher prices for energy. He's counting on the coalition that's been created to fight the war breaking up. I'm a little bit less worried about attention spans in the U.S. Hmm. As I said, having just come back from Ukraine myself, the war is that it is genuinely difficult to describe and explain now, after the really shocking events of February and March, and I do think that as it begins to change, there will be more coverage will return, and I'm also convinced, at least up until now, that in Washington, in certainly in Congress, and I hope also in the White House, there's a longer term commitment to fighting the war and making sure that Ukraine remains a sovereign state. And so the fact that Americans aren't watching it on television all the time bothers me. Actually, the Ukrainians worry that Americans aren't watching it on television all the time, but I'm less worried about that. I don't feel that the commitment to the war or the understanding of the war is changing. And I think for the for the most part, there's really amazing bipartisan consensus. It's almost the first thing we've all agreed about, I don't know, in about a decade. I have a theory about it, which is that, you know, if there's been this kind of somewhat false, well, very false cultural war in the U.S. between somehow mushy liberal values on the one hand and some kind of hard-edged patriotism or nationalism on the other hand, one of the things the Ukrainians have shown us is that you can have a full-on patriotic, you know, tough defense of liberal values. And the president of Ukraine is showing us what that looks like. And I think there's a reason why it appeals to a lot of Americans.
And when I think about Russia, I think about who's going to come after Putin. I mean, it's probably going to be some KGB thug, just like he is. And people are like, we get rid of Putin, what are we going to have? Who knows? But when I think about it, I also think about this unbelievable guy, this guy Navalny, you know, who, I mean, you've obviously had to have studied, you know, people like Sharansky, who sat in the gulag, people like Navalny. How do they do what they do? How do these folks, you know, they know Navalny went back, right? He knew that when he went back, what they were going to do to him. How do they do what they do?
It's funny. I've been thinking a lot about Navalny, and I was planning to write about him. And then the war started, and somehow the context in which I was writing needed to change. Navalny is somebody who is has spent a lot of time thinking about how to reach ordinary Russians, how to motivate people, what are the issues, what are the arguments that can reach people. And I think his decision to return to Russia was partly about modeling what civic bravery looks like. For those of you who are listening who don't know, what happened was that Navalny was poisoned. He's the most prominent opposition leader in Russia. He was poisoned. His supporters got him out of the country. They got him to Germany. They got him to a hospital where he was cured over many months, it has to be said. And he recovered in Germany. His wife and family joined him there. And then he made the decision, by the way, not only to return to Russia, but to first create a video, an extraordinary video, it's a 2-hour-long video, describing the corruption of President Putin and focusing on this ghastly, vulgar palace that Putin has built by the Black Sea. And Navalny made an elaborate video of it with all kinds of information that they got from people who'd worked on it and so on. He literally put it online, and it went online as he was flying back into Moscow. And so when his plane landed in Moscow, first of all, there were supporters already at the airport. There were people taking pictures of him on the plane just because they knew what was going to happen when he landed. And he was arrested immediately as he landed. But he was doing that to show, you know, I really care. Here's what bravery looks like. You know, if I can do it, you all can do it too. So, and this is the kind of involvement in public life he's been encouraging people to do for the last decade or so. And he decided that he had to show it himself, that he wouldn't, by remaining outside of Russia, he wouldn't be able to show the Russians how to resist their regime. And by the way, the return is controversial. I mean, if he were outside of Russia right now, for example, he'd be a really, really important voice in the war against Ukraine. So it's in some ways a tragedy that he's not outside. But this is a commitment to changing Russia, and this is why he did that.
I wanted to talk a little bit about we're discussing here sort of crafting these narratives and what actually breaks through. And you had a recent article, the reason Liz Cheney is narrating the January 6th story in The Atlantic, and you talked a little bit about. You sort of framed, in some ways, the January 6th committee of creating must-watch TV. In a nation that watches Netflix and binge-watches, we now have something that has cliffhangers, it has surprise witnesses. We're starting to learn how, somewhat effectively, to communicate to an audience at home who may be prone to turn this off. I'm curious to see, do you think it's having an effect? And also, what do you see the downside of our shifting narratives or our narrative styles being?
So the most important thing about the January 6th hearings was that almost everything that was said by Republicans. And not just Republicans, it was said by Trump Republicans. I mean, okay, Liz Cheney is not a Trump Republican, and she was really the leader of the hearing. She ran, you know, essentially the Democrats handed it to her and had her run it. But most of the witnesses, with a few important exceptions, but most of the witnesses were people who had worked for Donald Trump. And so I think the idea of the hearings was to show in the least partisan way possible. In other words, to use the language of people who worked for Trump and have that reach people. And then, as you say, secondarily, they also decided that the traditional format of hearings, which, remember, is a format that grew out of, you know, I don't know, 18th century parliamentary politics and, you know, dates back to an era before television and certainly before social media, that it wasn't working. It wasn't going to reach people in the same way, that people aren't used to watching a congressional hearing or a congressional committee meeting in the way that they're used to watching, you know, video clips and a constantly changing narrative. And I actually approve of that change. I think it would be really important actually for politicians to think, and really for us to think about reforms to the congressional process, you know, so that politics doesn't seem so alien to people, so that it's somehow events are happening, you know, take place in a form and in a setting that people find recognizable. And that doesn't mean it has to be superficial. I don't think the January 6th committee was a superficial presentation. Actually, it went quite deep. There were, you know, a lot of nuanced points made and so on, but it was, they tried to do it in a way that people would find easier to access and understand. And maybe there's a broader lesson for politicians more generally. You know, if you want to communicate with people, you have to use the language that they use. I'm not a communications expert, and I don't want to tell people how to run their political campaigns, but it might be a useful lesson for the future.
You know, one of the things that concerns me, Anne, is that it seems as though if you want to raise money, if you want to get elected, you have to go to the extreme. You have to get attention. Do you think there is a way for the middle to be interesting? Or is it human nature that, you know, we don't really care for the middle? We really want the extremes, because that's you go to a race, the car race, people say they go to car race, you're going to see a crash. You go to a boxing match to see a knockout. I mean, but is there a way, in your judgment, that we can make the middle very interesting?
I feel that that's my question for you. I mean, it should be possible. You know, there were aspects of Joe Biden's presidential campaign that I thought were very interesting. I watched several of his ads, and there were one or two of them. There was one in particular that I remember that was about work and family, and it sort of showed ordinary people commuting. They were going on a train, or they were going on a bus, or they were walking to work. And the narrative was something like, I don't remember it word for word, but it was something like, every day you go to work, you know, why are you going to work? You're going to work to take care of your children, to take care of your family. And then they showed, you know, pictures of children and families and so on. We know what motivates you, and we want to help you, you know, make it easier for you to do that and easier to take care of people. And it was quite moving. And I mean, maybe just a touch sentimental, but it seemed to me that the language of that.
Nothing wrong with that. But you're hitting on what I said earlier, which is people are not really interested in all your tax plans and all that other stuff. They want to know, do you get them and do you care about them?
Right.
And it sounds what you're describing. And that's why I think Biden, you know, the Democrats finally said, we're not going to win with anybody else. We better go with somebody who is in the middle and make people comfortable. Because, you know, you don't want to go to a doctor who's way out there on the extremes. You want to go to one who's got a lot of experience and can do a good job. But I think making the middle itself, communicating, if you look online, right, it's all this wacky stuff that people put on there. It's extreme stuff. It's nothing in the middle. And I think it's up to all of us to figure out how to make the middle interesting. And maybe it's connecting with people at that very basic level.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think, you know, it just requires some different level of creativity.
It does.
And you can't sound like a Washington bureaucrat. You know, you have to, as I said, use the language and images and media or social media that most people now see through which most people see the world.
Yeah.
But I think people can be moved by ordinary messages and by feelings of strong sympathy and so on. So, and there are, you know, there are positive emotions that can link people as well as negative. I mean, the negative emotions are maybe easier and quicker to come up with, but they also repel people. And so
The difference between negative populism and positive populism. Positive populism, where you sit down with somebody and say, I get it, and we'll work together. Negative populism, where you're blaming somebody else, which is the way that Orban and a lot of demagogues operate. The reason you got problems is somebody else took your stuff. And positive populism is, yeah, you're really hurting, but let's figure it out.
Yes, I mean, this is a side issue. I mean, one of the issues is that the nature of modern social media, for a variety of reasons, encourages emotion and anger and division simply by the way the algorithms work. And that's a longer conversation for another time. But
yeah.
It's not so much that the social media needs to ban people or take stuff down. I think that's the wrong way. But thinking about how those algorithms work and which kinds of emotions and conversations are being encouraged is something that we should all be interested in. But yes, you're right. I mean, through history and through American history, you know, we've always had presidents who bring people together by inspiring them. And who make inspiring, unifying speeches. I mean, you know, I mean, you can talk about Lincoln, you can talk about Obama, you can talk about, you know, Eisenhower, FDR. I mean, it's a nonpartisan skill. Both Democrats and Republicans have been able to do it in the past. Reagan, of course.
If they can just get an inspiring, thoughtful speech down to a 15-second TikTok with some sexy editing and lean towards moderation, our democracy is going to be fine.
That's right.
Well, Anne's
great summary.
Great, that's in a nutshell. Well, Anne's newest book, Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism, is available now wherever you get books, and visit annapplebaum.com for more. And thank you for giving us your insights.
Thank you.
Hey, everybody. Jordan here, your favorite host of the Kasich Klepper podcast. Thank you for listening this far. If you like what you hear, click like or thumbs up or whatever icon signifies a positive reaction. We love your ratings. We love your thoughts. Reach out to us on social media. Let us know what you want us to talk about, because I'm tired of answering the governor's questions, and I just prefer to answer yours. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon. Kasich and Klepper is a production of Treefort Media, hosted and executive produced by John Kasich and Jordan Klepper. Treefort Media's executive producers are Kelly Garner, Lisa Ammerman, and Matthew Kuglin. Line producer is Oscar Guido. Associate producer, Lee Albanese. Audio direction by Tom Monahan, head of audio for Treefort, with production and editing by Maxwell Carney. Sound editing by Abigail Sullivan. Talent booking by Blythe Asher. With additional production help from Tim Schauer, Haley Mandelberg, Lindsay Whistler, Colin Motel, and Anastasia Ibrahim. This podcast is powered by Acast.